Today in the Exponential Organization podcast, I interview Jeff Booth, the author of The Price of Tomorrow. This is one of those interviews where I, as the podcast host, was completely out of my depth, but I hope it allows Jeff to convey his vital message contained in the book. At the end of the interview, I'll be looking at chapter 10 of his book, which is titled Call to Action. Enjoy the interview. Welcome to the Exponential Organization podcast. I'm your host, Lance Pepler. The world is changing at an exceptional rate. Companies need to not only continue to innovate, but also grow exponentially to keep up. This podcast will introduce you to the principles of exponential growth and how you can adopt them into your business. This show is sponsored by IdeaStorm, a leading exponential growth consultancy that can provide services ranging from an hour advisory call with a network of over 4,500 consultants worldwide through OpenExo through to the 10-week EXO Sprint. So visit www.ideastorm.co.za to find out more. Today, our guest is Jeff Booth. Jeff is a visionary leader who has lived at the forefront of technology change for 20 years. He led BuildDirect, a technology company that aimed to simplify the building industry for nearly two decades through the dot-com meltdown, the 2008 financial crisis, and many waves of technological disruption. In January 2020, Jeff released his first book titled The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is Key to an Abundant Future. In it, Jeff offers his provocative thesis about the current state of our economies and what must happen to enable a brighter future. Jeff is featured in Forbes, TechCrunch, Inc.com, The Globe, Mail, BNN, Fast Company, Entrepreneur, Bloomberg, Time, and The Wall Street Journal. In 2015, he was named BC Technology Industry Associates Person of the Year, and in 2016, Goldman Sachs named him amongst its 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs. And I remember you being part of the Young Presidents Association as well. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, I am.
Welcome to the podcast, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Lance.
Jeff, where am I speaking to you from today? And could you give us a bit of your background, apart from the illustrious background that I've just read out?
You're speaking to me from, I'm about at our lake house, about an hour outside of Vancouver, BC. So beautiful day today. My background, you said, I've been a tech entrepreneur. So first started a number of tech companies, now on the boards of numerous high tech or technology high growth companies. So today I have a lens of how fast technology is shaping the world.
You recently released your first book, The Price of Tomorrow. Why did you write the book? And can you give us a brief overview of the book?
Sure. Why I wrote it is really for my kids. And when I zoom out, the kind of the future of all kids, their world won't look like the same world we grew up in, unless something is done to change the financial system that is currently in place for most of the world today. There's this interesting analog to what's happening in tech, and it's engineers in Canada, anyways, and I think it's been replicated in most parts of the world. Engineers in Canada, because of a bridge collapse in the 30s, get an iron ring to symbolize our work has consequences. And when that bridge collapsed, a whole bunch of people died. And so every engineer that graduates gets it's not iron anymore, but a ring that symbolizes that bridge collapse. And our work has consequences. Our work in technology, our work has consequences too. So when you roll up those consequences, most of them good, just about every technology entrepreneur I mentor or help their business is trying to make the world a better place through technology. So it's not necessarily that people are trying to do bad things. It's just it's butting up against a system that can't work anymore.
Why can't it work? What is particularly wrong with the system at the moment?
So technology is deflationary, and that sounds like potentially a bad thing, because we grew up thinking deflation is bad, inflation is good. But if you actually dig a little deeper on deflation or inflation, Deflation is when your money is worth more. So goods and services cost less over time. And inflation is the opposite. Your money is worth less and goods and services rise in price over time. So it's not good or bad. It's different winners and losers. So if you have deflation and things get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, then debt explodes in real terms. You can't pay it back. And so if you've leveraged up with a whole bunch of debt, that can never be repaid with deflation. It can only be repaid through inflationary monetary policy. So you have technology driving deflation everywhere in the world and staggering and exponentially so. So a good indication is if you look at your smartphone, is only 13 years old. And look at all the apps that you use from your camera to your maps to the information that you have. All of it, most of it is free or almost free. I can buy last year's cell phone on a plan for $50 a month and have more power than presidents had in my hand. It's 30 years ago. Mm. And we see it in small pockets like that in our cell phones. And we see, wow, we get more and more for less all the time. And that same technology is moving at lightning speed across every industry. So it's logical to assume if we see that sort of abundance and cost coming down everywhere, then or in our phones, we should see that in society in general. All prices should be coming down, but they're not. Mm. And that becomes the problem. And they're not because governments fight to stop deflation is printing money out of thin air and creating debt and wash the world in debt to be able to stop that deflation from happening, because we grew up in an inflationary monetary policy, and that structural change, governments can't see it. They can't see the path to be able to solve it.
Now, your book is called The Price of Tomorrow, and I mentioned I attended your presentation and session at Exo World, and I try to follow all the different logic around this. I seem to remember that it was our children that are paying the price for today, for tomorrow. How does that work? Why? What is the price for tomorrow?
So for some numbers, globally, in the last 20 years, debt has increased $185 trillion of new debt to raise global GDP by $46 trillion a year. That was before the COVID crisis. But it's predictable. And every year, more and more debt it needs to be created to pretend we live in the old world, right? And all that debt, let's simplify it. If it's just you, right, and you take out $1 million loan and you can't pay for $1 million loan, you can still live really well for a while, right? And everybody, if they don't know you have a loan, everybody thinks you're rich, you're spending, hiring gardeners and everything else, and you're driving the economy because of your spending. But that spending has to be paid back at some point. So by borrowing today, you have to pay back that money later on with interest. Right. And then if instead of paying it back, instead of taking $1 million loan and you can't pay back $1 million loan, you add a $2 million loan to pay some of the interest back. And then you add a $4 million loan for yourself. Now zoom that up to economies all over the world. And that's what's happening. And so you can pull forward demand. You can pull forward demand, but it has to be paid back at some point.
Now, who do the countries owe money to? Is it, because it's not China, is it the International Monetary Fund, or who actually lends the money?
Yeah, so you used to have fiat currencies backed, or you used to have currencies backed by gold before 1971. And on Bretton Woods, gold, US dollar was a reserve currency, but it was pegged to gold. After 1971, government started, US went off the gold reserve and arbitrarily changed the value of their money. And then every other country, not every other country, but Japan and China, and everybody has their own currency. And so what ends up happening is you lose the foundation of trust between governments. So governments end up printing more money to drive inflation. But every time you do that, you start. Oh, it's just a little bit. We'll bail out the system, and we'll print some money to do it. Every time you're doing that, you're manipulating prices and warping capitalism. So when you do that, again, you're trying to drive inflation against a deflationary pressure. You're actually picking the pocket of savers and enriching asset owners instead of assets falling, like. So let's say the 2008 financial crisis as an example. So the same architects of the crisis were rewarded when their bets didn't go to zero. They were bailed out by the government, and essentially, you in a free market, you win or you lose, you go to zero. If you can win, if you can have unlimited upside, and a government fails and protects your bet on the downside, you don't have capitalism anymore. But that bet that was protected instead of prices falling to what they actually should have fallen meant all the people with savings lost, right? Because they would have bought those asset prices for pennies of the dollars and had new fortunes. And all of the people with debt and the people that created the crisis won. And so it's just it becomes socialism for the rich.
Now, Jeff, your book, because it seems outside of your domain, your expertise is like IT, like we started. I'm saying, what got you to research this and start to get involved in the concept of the price of tomorrow and what needs to be done? What set you off on this trail, this journey?
So I couldn't square the peg when I looked at what was that. So I'm one of the winners, right? I'm in technology companies right now, specifically. They're all setting records. The technology is advancing faster. I own assets, and those assets, if governments are going to stimulate, are worth more money, right? And the people without assets that are working for wages can't keep up with the rise in those asset prices because of the stimulation. So, but if you actually zoom out a little further as for one of the winners, if you keep doing that and warping society, a logical consequence is the have-nots rise up against the haves with pitchforks. Right. That's what, and if you looked at, when I looked around the world and all of the rhetoric on politically and the division of society that was happening was predictable, or it's all predictable consequences out of what's happening in the world today. Because when somebody feels left out of society, they can easily be turned to believe it's not their fault, it's somebody else's fault. From creating, say, an unjust system.
Is this for housing and like entry into the housing market or jobs in general?
It's way bigger than that. So if you looked at, it's across every single asset category in the world. Let's use university tuition as an example. Mm. If there wasn't that much debt that could never be paid back in the form of student loans, right, would university tuition be as high? And it wouldn't be. The free market would. So and the debt itself isn't a negative. The debt would naturally slow growth in the future because you have to pay it back. Where things really get out of control is when governments say, change the rules of the game to not pay back, to change the, so let's say you and I are trading and we're in different countries, right? And you borrow and I borrow a whole bunch of money from you that I can't pay back, and then I borrow more and more, and then I pretend to pay you back by changing the zeros on my currency. you probably don't trust that trade anymore. So an exchange of value is just about trust. And so if you start breaking the trust in that exchange of value, the predictable consequences emerge.
So I'm trying to understand this. I come from South Africa, and in South Africa, we've actually got the biggest gap in the entire world between the rich and the poor, which is really bad. And so our government is focusing on trying to raise, the poorer communities and empower them and uplift that, which is really good and noble, and that's what needs to happen. But are you saying, let's say the rand dollar exchange rate used to be 1.10 and now it's 1 to 18, is that what you're kind of saying about the inflation?
Part of it, but what you're saying right now in South Africa is endemic across the entire world. Rich and poor gap has never been higher.
Yeah. Right.
And that gap is because you're artificially creating asset prices that are higher. You're not letting them fall. Right. So here's an easier way to say it. If you didn't print $185 trillion of new money, if you didn't create that debt, $185 trillion to produce $46 trillion of GDP growth, what would house prices be? They would be lower. So we're trapped in an illusion that prices of real estate always go up because we're manipulating the system to make them all go up. And so how that's connected is if China citizens know that they're going to devalue the currency to keep their labor rate artificially low, then those Chinese citizens have to take their money out of China and put it in South African real estate. Oh. And so you get this warp economic structure all over the world. And what creates that wealth gap is those people without the assets get killed. You're picking the pocket. And what's worse is then governments who created the problem in the first place by manipulating currencies then have to pay people on the lower class and middle class more in social safety nets to pay for the higher prices that they created in the first place.
Now, you spoke about a pitchfork scenario, people rising up. How does that look? I presume you don't mean actual, I suppose you might mean rioting in the streets, but how does it play out? Can you give us an idea?
In the US and Canada, gun sales have never been higher, which is a frightening thought. You can feel the anxiety in society, and it's not just COVID. It's people care. People are worried about their economic well-being and how they'll feed their families. Mm. And when that starts to happen, politicians typically create enemies out of other people to be able to, and whether that enemy is, it's not Republicans, it's Democrats, or it's not Democrats, it's Republicans, or all over the, it's this political party that got us into this problem. Mm. People want to believe that. And once they believe it's other people, it's really hard to change, to change that. It's really hard to unring that bell. So you create division in society. So go back to your South Africa thing, example. And remember, I would be one of the people that is in the upper class, right? Mm. And so let's use this as an example in South Africa. So there's a bunch of people that unnaturally, not known to them, their wealth wasn't generated by their ingenuity. Their wealth was generated by having asset prices in the right areas at the right time when governments just went all in on currencies, right? So their value went up. And when I say that, it's not just that. So the value of their housing, value of the commercial real estate, everything went up because of that. And so did their stocks. But that same rise that wasn't from their own ingenuity. It was from what governments did. It's a flip of a coin that could have looked the other way. Right.
Yeah.
They don't see that it also picked the pocket of an entire class of society. And so when government comes back and says, we need to tax you more to pay for the other side, those people, what do you mean? It's a free market. You're going to kill business. Mm. Right? And so the problem, and that's why I say it's a structural problem. And the losers don't realize that the winners were artificially gifted. No one realizes kind of the fundamental problem is that you're kind of warping how capitalism works and how free markets work, and that's what's creating the divide. Okay. Neither side realizes it, and the solutions today seem to be on top of the existing system, making it worse. So you get UBI, which is really universal basic income, which says, okay, we created all this wealth. Now we're going to piece off a little bit and give to you, so you can make way. You can live.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think, like you mentioned, the exponential technology situation and the boom of technology is actually, causing. Creating less jobs than they were. They're taking jobs away, making things more efficient, automation, robotics, and all these type of technology improvements are probably reducing more jobs than they're creating. At least that's what you said at ExoWorld as well. So that's going to cause a situation as well where unemployment surely is going to go up around the world as well.
That's the problem. That's what governments. So governments are trying to drive jobs with their policies, right? So ultimately, that's what they're doing. By pulling demand forward, you can short term create jobs like with more debt, right? Just like if you spent more personally, your internal economy would look way better until you had to pay back that debt. So governments can do that, and short term they can stimulate more jobs. But it comes at the expense of long-term jobs or slower growth. Mm-hmm. In a normal world. In today's world, when you have a technology that's driving exponential kind of deflation, then we're asking the wrong question. We're asking every government around is asking how do we retain more jobs, and at all costs, even costs that they know is kind of wrong for society, right? let's print more money, let's drive more jobs. When the question we should be asking is, how do we create a society that doesn't need as many?
You mean doesn't need as many jobs?
Yeah, when John Maynard Keynes, when he wrote an essay in 1930 called The Economic Possibilities of Our Grandchildren. And in that essay, he predicted, because of technology gains, I think it was, he predicted by the year 2020, humanity would be working a 15-hour work week. Oh. And it was a logical conclusion because of the increase in tech, in the exponential rate of technology. And he saw it in 1930. That hasn't happened because we've created a system that is pushing some of the wealth into hands of very few and taking it from others. So that's why that hasn't happened. So it's just lopsided. So what if we could ask a question, how do we design society? I can't imagine why price is going down. Okay, before I say this, because people will question this on the board. Okay. Short of, there's too much debt in the world already. Short of a whole bunch of structural problems that were created and by the way we've run our economies, I can't imagine why lower prices and working less is a bad thing. Why are savings bad?
Well, I presume then you'd have to be paid more per hour or paid a higher, value per hour that you worked.
Not if prices come down.
Yes. So if electricity is free and cars are free, yeah.
Yeah, but play some of these scenarios forward. You're looking where we are now and you're projecting the current forward. Right. If you read the book, you'll see you will not project the current forward anymore. You'll see what's actually happening. So play some of these. Play some of these scenarios forward. The number one input of all economies is energy. It's about 10% of world GDP.
Yeah.
And for a long time, we got our energy from digging up animals and plants that had died millions of years ago, extracting that energy and on a long, complicated channel to market, to be able to put gas in our car and coal into our coal mines. And in that model, the lowest cost energy always wins economically, right? Mm. It's hard to change people's economy. If it's the number one input in your economy, right? And somebody has coal and it's way cheaper than your oil, or somebody has oil and it's way cheaper than the oil that you buy, their economy wins and you lose in a world that's trading together. Today, looking forward in that future, that's moving to solar.
Yeah.
And solar at some point will move to free or almost free.
Mm.
And abundance creates free or nearly free. And technology creates abundance. And I'll give you a point that people don't. Economics is about scarcity. It's not about value. Mm. The air you breathe is the most valuable thing in your life right now. Why don't you pay for it? And so technology is going to create that abundance everywhere.
So let's pivot to solutions or scenarios. And I mentioned in the script that I sent through to you quite a famous scenario planner in South Africa called Clem Sunter. And he had a really pivotal role in changing South Africa and bringing about democracy, I believe. Because he went to the government and he said, this is the high road, this is the low road. You know, low road is the pitchfork scenario. High road is the one where we can all get along and really great country that we're going to live in the future. And generally, I suppose you land somewhere in the middle. Can you possibly say what would cause a high road scenario for the world? It's such a difficult question, but what would need to take place?
I don't think it is. I don't think it's actually that difficult a question. I think that's actually the interesting thing about you mentioning Clem is I was first introduced to him by a friend here that's from South Africa when he read my book. Mm. And he said, you've just put forward a high road solution. And so,
yes.
So the high road solution is designing society that you don't need to be on a treadmill to chase higher asset prices, designing society to take advantage of the abundance that technology allows. Capitalism would work perfectly, by the way. The people who'd want to work more would create the value and be paid as prices came down, be paid more of the pie that for the value that they created. And the people that fell off as jobs were naturally taken out of the market wouldn't fall so far. So a high road solution. Now, first of all, I don't think any individual government could do this on their own. You need to have a currency that is common, or currencies that can't be arbitrary. You can't change the rules individually in countries. So Bretton Woods that created great benefit for all countries on a common currency created a structure that the world could cooperate. And today we don't have that structure. So governments would have to come together to create that structure, and a digital currency country's own digital currency doesn't solve that. It has to be more common. I suspect something like Bitcoin could, right? But it would have to be adopted by many countries or pegged to by many countries, so they couldn't arbitrarily change the rules. And then if you did that, gravity would do the rest. And the way I say that is technology would just, the natural forces of capitalism would take play, and people wouldn't be working 40 or 80 hours to try to pay for artificially rising asset prices that were created artificially in the first place.
Okay. All right. So can I break that down a little bit? Let's say that Donald Trump gets reelected as president of the United States as a scenario. Are we? And I don't know what you think, but he doesn't strike me as the person who would enter into this sort of arrangement, or maybe he would.
I'm going to go backwards,
right?
In this. And this is what it's mind-boggling that people can't see. Donald Trump in 2008 would have been wiped out to zero. All of his real estate assets would have gone to failed. All of the debt against it would have failed, and he would have been bankrupt everywhere. No money. If natural forces were allowed to take place in 2008, instead, saving a system enriched certain people at the expense of others.
Yeah.
Donald Trump was one of those people that was enriched. And then people believe it's because of his ingenuity and they elect him as president. Right? It's like we're living in bizarro world. That things that should happen don't happen, and then we believe we believe that it's because of his ingenuity. And if market capitalism would have taken place, he would not be president today. So now we fast forward to where we are right now. Why would his solutions, the same solutions that have enriched him his whole life, why would they be any different today looking forward?
But that is the question. It probably won't be. And the share buyback scenarios and all that is happening because of the tax system there, et cetera, is feeding into the scenario or the situation that you say is being created.
Yeah, and at some point you have social upheaval that if that keeps happening, if the U.S. won't lead the world in a more prosperous world uniting type of way, other countries will take the lead.
So the crazy thing is we've got two more minutes left of this interview. and so maybe in 2 minutes, and it's impossible, so maybe I give 3 minutes. It's like a scenario where the world could sort of rectify itself, because what you're saying is quite simple, means that countries need to come together. They need to cooperate. They need to have a common good. And a lot of rich people need to lose money, it sounds like to me. And then we need to start from almost a common base and then from the beginning again, a reset button. Is that kind of summary, really, really badly summarized what you said?
Yes. So I would say it differently. Every crisis provides an opportunity. Same in business, same in government, same in everything else. And there's an opportunity to lead right now. There's an opportunity to lead through hope and positive impact on other people. And if more people would get out of the weeds and see they're fighting over a same system and come up and actually have a debate about the real drivers, and then how do we transition? Because you can't just transition all at once to what I'm saying. How do we build a transition to the high road? If more people would, if you, this interview, took this message forward, you'll have an impact. Right. If more and more people start doing that, that impact will change it.
Okay. Well, I said to you before the interview that I actually haven't read your book, but I need to. And I don't do book reviews on this podcast, but I need to do a book review. And I honestly believe, like Salim Ismail told me that Tony Robbins said he was one of the handful of people that could change the world. And I believe that you could be included in that handful. And so I want to wish you the best of luck. And if there's anything I can do to help facilitate this in a small little way, I'd really love to. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks a lot, Lance.
Thank you for your time, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. See you. Bye-bye. I ran out of time with my interview with Jeff Booth, and so I just wanted to take a couple of minutes talking about Chapter 10 of his book, Call to Action. This is the crux of the book and is the culmination of the previous 9 chapters. I'm hoping that you don't use the summary as a reason not to buy the book, as the first 9 chapters are excellently written and thought-provoking. It's also quite difficult to talk about Chapter 10 without the context of the first 9 chapters, and so another reason to buy the book. So to Chapter 10, A Call to Action. Jeff states that there are 4 ways that government tackles economic crises. 1, austerity, spending less. 2, debt defaults, restructuring. 3, the central bank prints money or other guarantees. 4, the transfer of money from those who have more to those that have less, much higher taxes for the rich. So austerity is hardly ever used because people don't like spending less. And defaulting of debts is extremely painful. So that leaves the last 2 options. Option 3 is to continue low or negative interest rate environment, central bank printing, modern monetary theory, or other guarantees to keep the party going. So this will drive the debt levels even higher, and it's only a short-term solution will eventually end in recession, and major recession. And then number 4 is higher taxes on the wealth and guaranteed basic income. So this option all requires wealth transfer. The idea is really simple in premise. Raising taxes on the wealthy to give a minimum basic income, whether people work or not, topping people up if they work to a maximum amount, or also not requiring them to work for their wages. The most important problem with the solution, though, is simply that it does not deal with the root cause, which is deflation. And if you read Jeff's the previous 9 chapters, like I said, deflation is caused by exponential technology. And so things are costing less, but debt is actually rising and asset prices are rising. So that causes a major problem. So deflation is caused by technology. And because of that, it will ride the same exponential wave that technology does. So those are the 4 options that governments normally use. But in Jeff's book, he gives another option. And I'm going to read directly from the book. So this is an extract from Jeff's book. So here is the extract. What if, instead of trying to stop deflation at all costs, we embrace it. As technology spreads, deflation happens at the rate it should. Deflation becomes something celebrated because it means we are getting more for less. We allow ourselves to accept abundance. Along that continuum, as technology removes jobs and fewer overall jobs are needed, prices will keep falling, allowing those who lose jobs a way to share in the benefit of technology abundance without massive transfer of wealth. If technology-driven price declines continue to the point of something becoming free, we let that happen too. People will no longer have to be on an endless treadmill to pay for things that are constantly rising in price. As hard as that may be for us to accept, because it's a much radical change of the way things are today, it seems to me that it's the only real choice we have. Consider this alternative. Allowing abundance without the jobs might actually open an entirely new enlightenment era where we have time to enjoy the benefits that technology brings. A true capitalist system would work well in that environment because there are still an incentive to work harder and innovate. Prices of all things would fall, yes, but those creating value would be paid for that value creation at a rate that matches the new realities of supply and demand and our digital world. So that's an extract from the book, word to word. And basically, he's talking about working less, paying less, things are less, and we embrace that. We embrace the fact that things will cost less. And therefore, the environment will mean that people will pay less, people have more money, people will be able to work less, and will almost create a utopia. There are challenges to this scenario. And hopefully, that everyone who's listening to this podcast, you and me, can help and spread this way of looking at things, and we'll make this a reality in our time. So once again, please go and buy Jeff's book, The Price of Tomorrow. It will be money well spent. So I hope you enjoyed the show and have learned as much as I did. If you'd like to contact me, Lance Pepler, then please do so by emailing lance@ideastorm.co.za or visit www.ideastorm.co.za. Until next week, goodbye.